Books, Hips, House versus Campania Management.
You got sworn in nickel time, didn't you, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Wait, Lee sits down with you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. All set? Please proceed.
My name is Joseph Gentleman. I represent Campania Management in this case.
Can you talk a little louder? That does not amplify.
Yeah, it does. No, it amplifies.
My name is Joseph Gentleman. I represent Campania Management in this appeal. There's actually two cases that were consolidated by the appellate court that are presently before this court. One is Campania's claim for malpractice against Rooks, Pitts, and Pouse, which was voluntarily dismissed. Then the trial court entered that dismissal with prejudice. That case was consolidated with Rooks, Pitts, and Pouse case for fees, which went to judgment after a bench trial. And Rooks was awarded $101,000 in change plus prejudgment interest. Today we're asking to have that judgment vacated, a judgment entered in favor of Campania, and leave to file a counterclaim based on a new claim of malpractice that attempted to be asserted by Campania in the underlying action. Essentially, the trial court committed three broad categories of reversible error. First was that it abused its discretion when it denied Campania leave to file various sets of amended pleadings. Secondly, the trial court erred when it entered a judgment in favor of Rooks, Pitts, and Pouse for its fees because Campania was an agent for disclosed principal. And third, the trial court erred when it awarded Rooks, Pitts, and Pouse prejudgment interest. To start with the fact that the trial court abused its discretion when it did not allow Campania to file amended pleadings. The first amended pleading Campania tried to or attempted to file was an amended answer to assert the agency defense. The trial court found that this was an untimely amendment and that Rooks would be unduly prejudiced. Now, if we look at the record here, it's very clear that there would be absolutely no prejudice suffered by Rooks, Pitts, and Pouse with the amended answer. Rooks claims that the new amended answer would interject new issues into the case, which would need more discovery. If you look at the record, that's really not true. The answer that Rooks filed to the legal malpractice complaint and allegation number four states that it knew about the existence of Credit General, the insurance company, and Campania, the managing agent for that insurance company. So it's not something that was not known by Rooks, Pitts, and Pouse prior to the time that this leave was sought to file with amended pleading. Secondly, there wasn't any discovery that would be needed. Campania turned over all the documents relative to this case in Rule 26 disclosures, so there would be no more documents that would possibly be needed. Secondly, any testimony that they would have needed would have come from their own employees, so they wouldn't have needed any oral testimony or depositions from anybody. And moreover, Campania, realizing that this may be a problem, offered to extend the discovery past the deadlines and give them anything they wanted to rectify any kind of prejudice that would be suffered. And it's important also to note that Rooks did not in the trial court and has not here in this court demonstrated or pointed out to the court what in fact this discovery may have been needed. Now, if you look at the cases regarding leave to amend pleadings, the fact that a discovery deadline is coming up by itself is not enough. You have to really demonstrate that you're going to be prejudiced in some way. So there was no prejudice demonstrated here by Rooks, and for that reason, Campania should have been allowed to file an amended answer regarding the defense that Campania was an agent for a disclosed principal. At the same time that it moved to amend the answer, Campania also moved to allege an affirmative defense regarding legal malpractice, which was denied. The trial court denied that leave to file that affirmative defense based on futility. It seems that the trial court put the cart before the horse and tried to decide the merits of the case before we were given leave to actually file the case. Notwithstanding that fact, if you look at the merits of the actual affirmative defense that was attempting to be alleged and where we sought leave to file that affirmative defense, it wasn't futile. It was a claim for malpractice, but it was based on a contingent finding of the court. First, the court would have to find that there was in fact a contract between Campania and Rooks, and if and when that was done, then Rooks would at that time owe Campania a duty under those contracts, one of those duties being reasonable care and skill of handling the case. So there was something similar to an indemnity claim where you needed a finding by the trial court before Campania would be allowed to assert this malpractice claim, because independently Campania didn't have the standing to bring that claim. So there was a contingency that was needed, and the claim was not futile, so it should have been given leave to file that affirmative defense. And finally, with respect to the amended pleadings, about a week after Campania sought leave to file these amended pleadings, it sought to file a new amended pleading of a counterclaim. This counterclaim had just accrued in between the time that the first motion for leave to file motion for leave to amend the pleadings was filed, and the time that the new motion for leave to file the amended pleadings was filed, because a state court action had been instituted by the plaintiff in the underlying action regarding the settlement of the underlying action, and these were new allegations of negligence because Rooks had included Campania in the settlement agreement when it shouldn't have been included in the settlement agreement because it wasn't the insurance company. These new allegations of negligence had just accrued within the week, and Campania immediately sought leave of the court to file these amended pleadings in this court so we could have all these issues heard at one time. The trial court found that motion to be duplicative. If you look at the counterclaim and the affirmative defense, they're not even close to being duplicative. They're completely different causes of action. So Campania should have been allowed to file those amended pleadings, including the counterclaim, and the trial court abused its discretion in all this respect when it failed to allow Campania to file these amended pleadings. It's the policy of the federal court to have all these issues tried at once, if possible, to preserve judicial economy, and that's what should have happened here. The second issue that's involved in this case is the fact that Rooks of Pitts and Powell received a judgment against Campania, and that the trial court committed error there because Campania was an agent for a disclosed principal. Now, this is where the record gets somewhat confusing. Originally, the trial court denied Campania's motion for leave to file an amended answer regarding this agency defense, but if you look at the record, it looks as if this issue was tried.
Who actually paid the man settlement?
Well, up until this point, Credit General has paid everything. There's a state court action in which I've already mentioned that Scott Mann had sued Campania and Frank Rowland of Rooks, Pitts, and Powell. Presently, Scott Mann has a judgment against Campania on the settlement agreement because they were included in the settlement agreement, where in fact Credit General should have been included in the settlement agreement because Campania was not the insurance company. Someone at Rooks really never figured out who their client actually was in this case, and that's what this agency argument is really about. I mean, they claim...
Well, their position as a client is Campania. That's who hired them to go out and do this work.
Right, but if you look...
And I thought your original defense had always been that they weren't submitting their bills to you in a timely fashion, that violated the agreement, so you didn't have to pay them, and this agency business came up just at the last minute.
Yeah, the agency issue came up throughout. It was kind of confusing at first. When you look at the documents, Campania did write the checks to Rooks, Pitts, and Powell and did write the first couple settlement checks, but they were reimbursed on the back end by the insurance company. So until you really get into the discovery of the case and look to see where the actual...
If the insurance company hadn't gone in the tank here, that wouldn't have been a problem.
But. Right, or if Campania was a little bit more careful in disclosing the relationship between it and Credit General at the inception of the retention of Rooks, Pitts, and Powell. And this has been happening to a lot of these different management companies in the last year or so when all these other insurance companies have went belly up. So, you know, people are looking for their fees. They're going to try to nail anyone for the fees. And here, if you really look at it, if you look at the documents that were admitted into evidence, Rooks, Pitts, and Powell knew that they were hired by an insurance company. They didn't know, maybe they didn't know the name of it, or maybe they thought it was the name of the insurance company was Campania, but like letter after letter demonstrates that, you know, the insurance company is the person that we've been retained by. Now, maybe originally they didn't know that Campania was the name of was not the insurance company, but soon thereafter, within a few months after being retained, they were given a copy of a deck page, which clearly delineated that Credit General was the insurance company. Campania was not. Campania was the producer or agent of the insurance company.
Well, it seems that once, when this arrangement is going to start going forward, it's completely within your control to let them know who's going to pay the bills.
Correct. I totally agree, and they've been advised to do that from now on in the future. But this recent case of Kimco, though, is right on point here in these agency disputes. If at the time of contracting, the agency relationship is not disclosed, generally the agent is on the hook. I guess I have to wait for the rebuttal to finish that point. But,
no, you can finish it right now. You will just be using up part of your time, that's all.
Is generally on the hook, but if after the time that contract is entered, the fact that the agency is disclosed to the third party, then the agent can be off the hook if it's an executory contract that's divisible. So you have to look to see if this is in fact a divisible contract and if there was sufficient disclosure of the relationship here. If those two criteria are satisfied under Kimco, which is a very recent case in Illinois, the agent is relieved of liability here. And Kimco's a very similar case to this because it has to do with an employment contract. It's the same type of situation you have going on here where it's an employment contract where you're being paid every few months for the work that's performed. And if you look at the evidence in this case, there was more than enough sufficient disclosure here of the relationship. There's letter after letter that Rooks knows that they're hired by an insurance company here. And Campania, when they turn over the... And after a few months, after the representation began, campaign in terms of the deck page, it's absolutely positive and clear then the insurance company's Credit General. At that point, Rooks has the opportunity to say, okay, well, I'm not going to represent Metropon anymore in this case because all attorney contracts are at-will contracts. Even if there is a written contract, either party can terminate it at will. So they had the choice then to deal with Campania or deal with Credit General. They chose to continue the representation knowing, in fact, that Campania was not the one responsible for the fees and ultimately Credit General was. And the fact that they're trying to now pin this the fees on Campania should not be allowed under this new Kimco case that has been a recent decision of the Illinois Appellate Court.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Please the court. My name is Donald Hubert and I represent the Rooks Law Firm. Your Honor, in a very strange way, this is a case reminds me of the adage of be careful of what you ask for because you may get it. We filed a 5-paragraph complaint in state court that just asked for $101,000.
Yes.
Pardon me?
Yes.
Yes. It wasn't $9 million like the prior case. So they filed a motion to remove. Now everyone knows that under the federal rules of procedure, the underlying objective is speedy disposition. Lawyers know when they go into federal court, the case is not going to sit around for years. They filed a motion to remove. And so they asked for it, and they got it. They came before Judge Conlon, and in August, she said, this is going to be the schedule. You're going to go to trial in February. Later on, they, contrary to what's in their brief, they filed a motion to change it, and we agreed. And so it got changed. We were sitting and looking at a January 22nd drop-dead date. Discovery closes. It's a very simple case. It's not $9 million. It's $100,000. Rooks is losing money every day that we're litigating. In fact, right now, they're litigating on principle because the money is in my pocket because that's how much they've had to spend to defend. Now, continuously, they have not argued the dismissal of their lawsuit. They filed a complaint in state court. That got removed. That was dismissed by the court with prejudice. They did not brief that issue. Rule 28 set forth the requirements for an issue to be decided by this court. They totally violated that rule. They didn't identify that issue as an issue in the issue section. They didn't set that out, that argument out separately in their brief. They did not include the court's ruling on the dismissal in their appendix of orders to be appealed. And even though we have continuously fronted them on this issue, their failure to properly set forth that issue on appeal, continuous with that prior conduct, they stood right up here on oral argument and still didn't argue it. The only thing that they're arguing before this court is that the dismissal, that when the, on the, on their motion to amend and the affirmative defenses, they say that the court abused its discretion. And of course, as the court knows, the abuse of discretion standard applies to the court's ruling on the motion to amend. It applies to the court's ruling on the motion to file the counterclaim, and it applies on the motion in limine ruling. Although they didn't raise it in an oral argument, the court's ruling on the trial errors is the clearly erroneous standard, and the court's ruling on the interest issue, again, is the clearly erroneous standard. I absolutely agree with the court that when we stood before the court ready to go to trial in this case, what we had here was a defense that the guidelines had been violated in not filing these invoices timely. And so what did they do? They came in on January the 16th, 4 or 5 days before the January 22nd date, and filed a motion to amend the answer. Totally changed their defense. Totally changed from the defense that the bills were not timely to the defense that there was a disclosed principal. They claimed that we were not prejudiced. Well, I asked them why then did they call us and say, well, we'll stipulate for you to do some discovery. Of course we were prejudiced. We were prejudiced because we were looking at a very simple case on January the 19th that tremendously was changed by the motion to amend. Additionally, the parties who were the players involved at the time that in October of 1994, when this agreement was entered into, Joanne Ivanzig, no longer employed by Campania. Kim Landis, no longer at Rooks. Patricia Dickey, no longer employed by Campania. The reality is that we did need to do additional discovery. Hey, what about discovery from Credit General? What about discovery from the insurance company? So the reality is we were tremendously prejudiced. The case law says when there's prejudice, the court does not abuse its discretion when it denies the motion. And that's precisely what happened here. Relative to the affirmative defense, the problem is that they recited as an affirmative defense that which was in their original complaint filed in state court, which was a recovery of the monies that had been paid under the settlement. And they admitted in their motion to dismiss that they had no standing, had no authority to litigate that issue. And so it was dismissed. As to the counterclaim, well, clearly the settlement agreement as drafted was the issue in the counterclaim. Well, that had not been raised, and that got filed on January 31st. Discovery had closed January the 22nd. So very clearly in the counterclaim, they were raising a wholly new issue. They cannot satisfy the abuse of discretion standard by contending that the court's use of the term duplicative motion means that there was an abuse of discretion. The court noted that it was a new counterclaim. The court noted that we were prejudiced. And the language duplicative motion is understandable. It was duplicative in the sense that they were yet again, as in the motion to amend with the affirmative defenses, they were trying yet again in the counterclaim to raise a malpractice, legal malpractice claim. And in that sense, it sincerely was duplicative. They started out their oral argument not raising the court's alleged errors at the trial, but I think what's really important here, we need not address the issue of divisibility, because the court ruled that the matter of the disclosed principle is a non-issue. Yes, the court, in some kind of dictum, as an afterthought, said, by the way, I don't think you've given them notice as to who pays the bills by sending this fax, but we had clearly established a very clear record. There was a motion in limine that issue not be litigated. The motion in limine was granted by the court. It was Campania in the pretrial order that continued to push the disclosed principle issue, as they have continued to do it here. While we would be remiss in our obligations to our client were we not in the pretrial order, in addition to filing the motion in limine, to also address the issue. But the motion was granted. And yet they say that we somehow, by additionally addressing the issue, have opened the door for the issue to be litigated. It was not litigated. It was a non-issue, as indicated by the court. And the court need not go any further on this issue regarding the disclosed principle. As to the interest, it was liquidated. They lost on whether the bills were being late constituted a breach that allowed Campania not to pay the bills. And they are bound by the clearly erroneous standard, an extremely high standard. But there is clear evidence in the record that the bills, in fact, were in the file. It was not only, as they indicated in their brief, the fact that Frank Rowland testified that it was his procedure to prepare the bills. The bills were prepared and given to the secretary to be mailed. Oddly enough, Sandra Krause admitted on cross-examination that they have what's called a finance file where the bills may have been contained, and she never looked in the file. The reality is the amount owed, billed monthly, was liquidated. It was a certain and fixed amount, and the court properly assessed the interest. And so, Your Honors, in conclusion, we ask the court to rule that they have not properly raised the issue regarding the dismissal with prejudice. We ask the court to rule that we were prejudiced when they filed a motion to file the amended answer, that we were again prejudiced when they filed the motion to file the counterclaim. We asked to find that the motion in limine was properly granted. Anything else would have been a contradiction to the court's earlier rulings that the disclosed principle was not an issue in the case. We asked the court to conclude that the court did rule, clearly rule, that the disclosed principle was a non-issue, and therefore the court need not plow deeply into the back and forth laws on disclosed principle and divisibility, and indeed possibly be called to engage in matters of first impression on state law. And finally, we ask the court to conclude that as to the interest, it was a liquidated amount, and the trial court properly assessed it. And finally, we ask the court to give Rooks some relief, to bring what was a $100,000 case that has now reached the August halls of the Seventh Circuit to an end. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
First, I'd like to address the fact that Campaign is bringing this case. This isn't a case to harass Rooks, Pitts, and Powell. It's a case to protect Campaign from a nationwide campaign against it for every possible law firm in the country coming after it for its fees. I guess one of the main issues here, the most troubling one, is whether or not this issue was actually tried, this agency issue. There was motions in limine, there was motions for leave to file, amended pleadings that were denied. But if you look at the actual evidence, the documents that went into into evidence that were agreed by both parties, and if you look at the testimony that was given by some of the parties during the trial, the issue was tried, maybe not as much as Rooks, Pitts, and Powell might like to realize, but it was tried. There's testimony on these issues, on the important issues, and there's documents regarding these issues. And when the judge uses the word, it's a non-issue, I mean, to me, that means that she just looked at the merits of the issue, and in her opinion, she didn't think it had any validity to it. So I really think that there was no reason why the issue shouldn't have been tried, and actually think that it was actually tried in the long run. I'd just like to say a few words about this prejudgment interest. You can only get prejudgment interest on liquidated amounts. Attorney's fees, if you look at the cases on attorney fees, it says that attorney's fees are within the discretion of the court or the trier of fact. And for an amount to be liquidated, it cannot have anything to do with judgment, discretion, or opinion. So by definition, this is not a liquidated amount of fee, so they couldn't recover any prejudgment interest in this case. And I'd like to thank the court's time for handling this case, and that's all I have for today.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement. Thank you both.